In today's show, I'm joined by Lucy West, who came highly, highly recommended from one of my Tuesday night mastermind people. Colin, thank you for the tip. And Lucy talks about how you need to listen more than you tell. The only way to introduce a new initiative, don't follow a pacing guide, follow the kids, and the contradictions we face in education. Thank you so much for tuning in. I do not take you for granted, and enjoy the show.
Welcome to the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast, where school leaders go to find inspiration and learn world-class strategies from top influencers in education. Better Leaders, Better Schools was created by Daniel Bauer.
Well, hey, Better Leaders, I am so excited to connect this evening or today, whenever you're listening. It could be morning, could be afternoon, with Lucy West. She was highly, highly recommended to me from one of my mastermind coaching clients. And I am, like I said, so excited to connect with her. Miss West is recognized internationally for her innovative, effective, and cutting-edge ideas and proven practices for transforming schools into multi-generational learning communities that thrive in the 21st century. She is uniquely qualified to assist school districts across the country because she has worked at every level of the system, from classroom teacher to building administrator to curriculum coordinator to district administrator, and is a consultant to urban, suburban, and rural districts. Lucy West established Metamorphosis TLC after her outstanding run as director of mathematics instruction in New York City's Community School District Number 2. Lucy, thank you so much for joining me on the show.
Thank you. I'm excited to do this.
So tell me, Lucy, what inspired you to pursue a career in education?
Well, actually, it's not a noble story. It became one, but it wasn't one initially. I was actually getting divorced. I had been in the theater for 16 years, and I needed a steady income. I also wanted to have the same schedule as my children. What's really funny is in 33 years of teaching, I've only had one summer off. So what happened is teaching became my calling, and I realized I had found the thing that I was supposed to be doing. And I really dedicated myself to becoming the best teacher I could and learning. So what seemed like a very practical decision became my destiny, so to speak.
You know, it's interesting because you made that decision to benefit your family, to be with your kids a lot more. What was it about teaching that it became your calling?
Well, I had actually dabbled in social service and in the theater. I had been, like I said, I was a dedicated thespian, as my father used to say.
Right.
And so the two fields, social service and theater, actually were the best training anybody could get for teaching. Because like being in a rep company or something like that, you really have to learn how to be a team and create teams. I was a director. So that fed me. And also it made me feel like teaching kind of on stage a lot of the time, even though I don't believe in the sage on the stage kind of teaching, you have to be interesting and creative and so forth to be a really effective teacher. And then the social service side of it opened my heart to the kinds of issues that kids bring to school and how to handle them and how the system works or doesn't work in our city, and particularly New York City. So those two things fed me a lot. And then the other thing is I went to Bank Street College of Education, which is probably one of the best colleges in the United States in terms of teacher preparation. And it was a very progressive school that taught me all kinds of ways of thinking and being that I hadn't had in my own education. So, for example, what people now call like project-based learning or integrated curriculum, Bank Street's been doing that for 100 years. And I was doing that in the 80s. We would put on shows, for example, that the kids built the sets for and wrote the scripts for and learned to sing and dance in. And I mean, we just did it, but that was how we taught math and literacy and social studies all in one. Or we traveled all over the city. One year we took 20 trips, 20 school trips. That was a trip every other week, practically. And we built all the landmarks that are in New York City, sort of to scale, and this was elementary school. So there was something exciting about it. It was creative, and I learned so much as I was going. Plus, I got totally fascinated by how kids learn and the different styles and the different ways that they think about things and how funny they are and, you know, how vulnerable and fragile they are and so forth. So it was heart opening, it was mind opening, and it tapped my passion. Kind of falling into the mathematics side of it was a bit of a surprise, because my master's is actually in conflict mediation and moral development. And I'll tell you, I learned how to deal with conflict during the math wars when I was director of mathematics in Community School District 2 for 48 schools.
Yeah.
And it was the heat of the math wars. It was 1980. I started teaching in 1983. So it was the early 90s that I was in District 2. And that's right after this first set of standards came out from the National Council of Teachers for Mathematics, NCTM. And we were implementing them and playing around with new curriculum materials and so forth. And my acting career came in very handy at that point, because I really had to handle large groups of parents and the newspapers and the board of education that was, at our district and so forth. So all of my experience leading into teaching fed the teaching.
That's a really interesting story, especially like your theater background, how you brought that in, and then a master's in conflict mediation. I was going to tell a joke and say I looked up math wars on Wikipedia and I couldn't find it, but I did find it when I just Googled it. I'm not sure if it's the same math wars that you refer to, but can you tell us a little bit more? You know, our listeners, they're dealing with conflict on a day-to-day basis as leaders in their school buildings on the front lines. And what type of tips do you have for school leaders that find themselves in a conflict?
That's my specialty. It's totally fascinating. So I have lots of tips. One, for the most part, leaders try to tell more than listen. And just like wonderful teachers, you need to learn to listen more than tell. So one of the first things that I learned as a leader is I've got to find out what's really going on, what people are really thinking. So, for example, if you work in a school where you have some kind of faculty meeting and everybody's quiet during the faculty meeting, they can't wait to get out, and you introduce something that you want them to do, whatever it is, and nobody says anything, or maybe somebody says something, questioning something, and then it's dropped and you assume that you've got an agreement. What follows is people going out into the parking lot and complaining. And when that happens, you know your culture is not a transparent, honest, and learning culture. So the way that administrators often introduce something to the staff will either make or break how that initiative is going to go. And a lot of times it's a top-down approach. So, you know, the district says we need to do XYZ, and then the principal comes to the teachers and say we need to do XYZ. And then the teachers, you know, grumble about it or not. They pretend they're going to do everything, but they're very unhappy about it and so forth. So one of the first questions I ask myself when we're thinking about introducing something or trying a new initiative is, who is missing from the table that initiative is going to impact? If the initiative is going to impact the teachers, then the teachers need to be part of the conversation of how to design that initiative and what choices they will have within the initiative and what support they will have within the initiative. Most initiatives are not designed that way. They're designed so that we try it for a year or two, it doesn't work, so we throw it out and try something else. That happens with curriculum materials on a fairly regular basis. The curriculum materials were chosen quickly or were chosen under pressure for some reason, and there wasn't enough voice and conversation and clarity about criteria and taking time to really investigate things. And so you end up with resistance. Wherever I go around the country, the number one question that coaches and principals ask me is, how do you deal with a resistant teacher? And I say to them, how do you prevent the resistance to begin with? Because by the way you do something, you create resistance or you create commitment. So for example, I never or try never to use the term buy-in. I don't want you to buy in. I'm not selling anything. I want you to be committed to something that matters to you and matters to me. I want to be open to thinking about more than one way to do something. And I'm also willing to look at the nuances in teaching rather than trying to come up with a mechanical answer, a technical answer for what's called an adaptable problem. So, for example, we have identified in almost every school that we have ever worked in that many of the elementary teachers, to begin with, we'll just start with elementary, probably 80%, don't have confidence in teaching mathematics. Their own mathematics knowledge is pretty procedural, and they are not clear themselves what big ideas there are that underpin the procedures and where to focus their energy. Now, since 1989, when the first set of standards came out, there was supposed to be a shift towards conceptual teaching of mathematics. Well, you can't teach conceptually if you don't understand that yourself. So what was the answer? Buy books, buy certain curriculum materials that are quite scripted, and so therefore you really don't need to know, you just need to follow the book. That's a mechanical solution to an adaptive problem, because no book is going to be able to give the teacher the kind of foundation she needs herself in order to teach mathematics well, to know when to actually follow the book and when to stray from the book, to adapt lessons in the book rather than use the context perhaps that is given in the book or the problems that are given in the book. You can't make those decisions if you don't understand the content deeply yourself. And I don't just mean like you should know calculus because you're teaching multiplication. That's not what I'm saying. You need to understand the number system, the operations, and deep structural ways. You need to understand that mathematics, for example, is the study of patterns and relationships. If you've never had that experience as a learner yourself, and now you're a teacher, how can you give it to kids? So that's called an adaptable problem, because we have to learn new things as we're trying to also teach differently. So no book is going to solve that problem. Therefore, we have to change the culture that says you as a teacher, when you come out of college or wherever you're coming out of, that you're supposed to know how to do everything in the classroom correctly. And when we have new demands on you, you should know how to do that too, without us having to do much to help you do that. And when you don't do it well, we see it as a motivation issue as opposed to a skill issue. What looks like motivation, like teachers are not motivated or they're resistant, 90% of the time is a cover-up for a skill issue. They really don't know how to do what you're asking them to do. If you look at it from a principal perspective, which I have, and I've been in that seat as an assistant principal, it's sometimes the principal doesn't know what to do and wants an easy solution to something. But sometimes that solution causes more problems. I'll give you examples. In mathematics these days, in many schools, there's something called the, quote, workshop model. And it has a formula to it. You're supposed to do a kind of a launch for a few minutes. The kids are supposed to work either on their own or collaboratively. And then you're supposed to have some kind of summary meeting where like that. Well, that's a lovely format. It might work for some lessons. It'll work for some kids. It'll work for maybe many kids. And it'll work most of the time. But it's not the only format. There are many formats that could work. And the format should match what you're trying to do. So when you use a format like that day after day after day after day, you're limiting what you can do in terms of differentiation, in terms of working with smaller groups of kids on particular things to either challenge them or to fill in a gap or what have you. You are missing opportunities to allow kids to explore things that are of interest to them and are relevant to the curriculum. So I guess what I'm saying is, how can we start to identify as leaders what needs to be learned in order to do better whatever it is that we're trying to improve, rather than impose some kind of ready-made solution that might have worked in a different school? So even the transfer, for example, of best practice, what does that mean? Best practice is best where it is designed for solving a particular situation. Now, that doesn't mean we can't learn from a school that had a situation that they had to come up with a new practice for. But to then try to implement that practice without having gone through the process of actually trying to solve a problem that practice actually solves, and playing with that practice to see how you have to mutate it in a new situation, you're going to only get the superficial implementation of that practice and you're only going to get superficial results. So I'm an advocate for principals and teachers to become critical thinkers, to question everything, to question the books they're using, to question the formats they're using, to question why they have the number of minutes they have in a class session, because human beings don't learn in 45-minute blocks or 60-minute blocks or 90-minute blocks.
Those are some really interesting ideas that you bring up. What I heard you say, some of it is identifying that who needs to be at the table, going way back to whenever you're trying to start a new initiative and that sort of thing, making sure all voices are included. I heard you talking about being agile and adaptive, and then closing with this idea of critical thinking and questioning everything. What would you say to the school leader that feels stuck, that feels weighed down by the pressure of bureaucracy, where they want to question, to your example, the 45-minute, 60-minute, 90-minute block, and some of those questions are in their heart and their soul, but they don't think they can change it? How do you help those school leaders become more adaptive?
I'd ask them what they were afraid of. What are you afraid of? If you actually started to think about what you want to create rather than what's getting in your way, we limit ourselves out of two things, fear and lack of imagination. So what are we afraid of? A lot of people are kind of operating on what I call automatic. We are operating from beliefs such as we cannot question authority. If the policy comes down that we're supposed to do X, we have to do that whether we like it or not. I disagree. I think that we have to examine that policy. And then we have to say, okay, what aspect of this policy do I agree with? Where do I see problems in this policy? Where do I see potential obstacles? And how can I start to think about ways of either addressing those obstacles, raising these issues with the people who are creating these policies in a way that can be heard. So, for example, I work with what we call teaching learning communities. And in these teaching learning communities are hand-selected teachers. They're generally hand-selected by principals, invited to be in this very special professional learning opportunity. And what do they say to me? Almost every time we have one of these teaching learning communities. But my principal says we have to be on this pacing calendar. We have to follow this pacing calendar. And we can't, so that's what I'm doing. I'm following this pacing calendar. And I say, okay, but what do you want to do? Well, I want to slow down. I want to make sure the kids understand something. So how do you have a conversation with a principal? Because both of you want the same thing. What you both want is for kids to learn. And you want those kids who are struggling and failing to do better. The principal may have offered this pacing calendar thing, and you feel tied to it. She's maybe even been pretty, strict about it in some way. How do you open the door to a conversation that allows for intelligent experimentation so that we can figure out if the pacing calendar is really the best way to go? And maybe you have some kind of pacing calendar, for example, chunked pacing calendar, like you have a month or whatever it is, say a month to 6 weeks to teach this major set of concepts in, let's say it's in number, maybe it's multiplication. You're gonna have a unit of study for X number of weeks, but I'm not going to tell you what page you need to be on each day, because at the same time that I'm telling you that, I'm also asking you to differentiate, to help fill in the gaps, to take care of the things that kids don't come to you already knowing, and so forth. Well, how are you supposed to do that if you're following a pacing calendar? What we need to be following is the kids. Like, where are they? What do they know? How can I build on what they know? And how do I work with them in smaller groups, in larger groups, in pairs, and so forth, so that they learn to learn together? They learn to learn with each other. That's much more complex than following a pacing calendar. Now, we might not know how to do that, and the pacing calendar makes us feel secure, but if you actually step back and ask yourself, where did this pacing calendar come from and why? Pacing calendars came from the anxiety that principals and other people had about making sure that we, quote, covered the curriculum, unquote. and that teachers didn't fall too far behind, so that teacher A was not on chapter 3 and teacher B on chapter 1. So we imposed the mechanical solution. That mechanical solution has exacerbated the problem. It hasn't made it better. In places that it's made it somewhat better is it's chunked big enough. You have a chunk of time and you have decent resources to help you actually. Maybe you have a coach. Like we provide a lot of coaching to people who want to be more differentiated in their teaching, who want to be more student-centered, who want to be more conceptual in their teaching, who want more student discourse. Our specialty is developing student discourse, specifically in mathematics. So a principal could step back and invite this teacher leader who she selected to go to this special, you know, teaching learning community that we're having and say, tell me what issues came up in that session. Maybe the teacher could go back to the principal and say, would you be willing to have a conversation with me about something I want to try? I know I'm supposed to be on the pacing calendar, whatever, but I'm learning something that I think would do better. And we don't have to let the whole world know we're trying this. But maybe in my classroom, I could try something. And if it seems to be working, I'll invite you in, principal, to come and see. And maybe we could talk about it together. And if it's working, maybe we could get a couple of more people to try it. And it might mess up our pacing calendar a little bit. And we'll have to keep negotiating that. Are you open to this? That kind of conversation where two people identify a mutual purpose they both care deeply about, and then intelligently experiment and kind of lift some rules just a little bit, change some schedules just a little bit in order to play in a space that allows for creativity and innovation, then we can improve what we're doing. It's a little scientific, it's a little artistic, and it's definitely a little risky. But from what I can see in most schools, they're not getting the results they want anyway. So why not try something else?
Yeah, what do you have to lose? You know, and again, I hear you talking about the critical thinking, the creativity, the innovation, the courage that you need to bring up some of these creative solutions, right, to attack some problems and stuff that's not necessarily working anyways. And I really like how you phrase that. You know, you're taking a very humble position when you talk to a principal or district administrator. Would you be willing, you know, what would happen if, would you be open to X, Y, and Z? And if it works, you know, allow me to pilot it. And if it works, maybe we can spread this thing and try to improve teaching and learning around campus. You also mentioned some really neat stuff about contradictions in education and coverage versus depth, the power of coaching. I'm wondering if we could stay there for a second with the coaching, and maybe you could tell us, the listeners, the story of starting Metamorphosis TLC, and tell us a little bit about the service you provide schools and the coaching that you provide.
We provide a very particular kind of coaching. It's called content-focused coaching, or content coaching for short. This is a researched form of coaching that builds on earlier models of coaching. It is not in any conflict with, for example, cognitive coaching or instructional coaching. What it brings to the table is a focus on content. So it started in District 2, Community School District 2 in the 90s was a lighthouse district. Lauren Resnick from the University of Pittsburgh Learning Research and Development Center was coming and studying what we were doing. Michael Fullan from Ontario was coming to study what we were doing. Richard Elmore from Harvard was coming to District 2 to study what we were doing. We were on the cutting edge. I would go to Pittsburgh 5 weeks out of the year, spread out over the year, studying with people at researchers at in Pittsburgh, and they would come to District 2 and videotape my work. At the time, I was coaching teachers in our district. We were building what we called collaboration sites, in which we were working with principals and teachers in particular schools whose practice was developing quite well, and they were getting great results, and we were coaching them so that we could then bring other teachers to these schools to study alongside them. And we never called them model sites because we don't believe in that. What we believe in is we are educators learning to get more skillful, more sophisticated, more nuanced in our practice. And so we study teaching and learning as the work of what teachers and administrators need to be doing. Through that process, we videotaped myself coaching dozens of teachers. And with my research colleague, who was a visiting professor from Switzerland, we developed what's called content-focused coaching. And our first book came out in 2002 or 3, and it was called Content-Focused Coaching, Transforming Mathematics Lessons. The question that we were researching is who coaches the coach? Because I was getting results. I was getting teachers to teach differently, and the kids were learning, and our scores were going up every year. So, and we had 48 schools, K to 12. So it wasn't like this was easy or that it was just in a couple of schools. This was in 48 schools. So we asked the question, who coaches the coach? Because now I was supposed to develop a cadre of coaches who could work in the 48 schools, because I was working in about 4 of them to get the work going. And as I was trying to teach other people how to coach, I really didn't know what I was doing that was so successful. I was just doing it. So the researcher and I studied our films. We studied the pre-conference, the lesson, and the post-conference rigorously. And we put 3 of these videos in our book. They show the pre-conference, the lesson, and the post. We learned many things. We named the moves I was making that actually showed up in the classroom as teacher change in practice. We raised deep questions about what needs to be done and how. So we value, for example, the pre-conference. We never go into a teacher's classroom without a pre-conference. And that pre-conference is a rich, deep lesson design session in which we created a tool called the Guide to Core Issues, which helps a teacher think about the what, the why, the who, and the how. Most teachers only think about the how. They have a book. It says, do this, do this, do this, gather these materials, and that's called the how. But when you actually start to think about the what is it you're trying to teach? That's where conceptual teaching comes into play. And when we work in mathematics, we identified 3 things in the what. What are the big ideas? What are the strategies kids are going to be using? And what are the mathematical models you're going to use to make sure that the kids have access to the math you're trying to teach? Strategies lead to skills, concepts lead to reasoning, and models are ways of expressing or representing ideas. That's huge. All 3 of those things are important in any content area. And our content-focused coaching started in math, but it works in any content area, and we've been exploring it in others. So we learned that if you don't design a lesson deeply and well, thinking first about the what, and then why are you teaching this lesson today to these kids, in this way? What are the reasons behind what you're doing? And most teachers have a hard time saying why they're doing what they're doing. It's next in the book. Well, that's not good enough in the way we plan lessons. It's fun. We want things to be fun, but they also need to be meaningful and relevant and worthy. Okay, then we say, who are the kids in your class? Oh, I have a wide range of kids. I have yet to hear a teacher say, all my kids are the same. Yet, they refer to all their kids as if they were the same. They say, they. I say, who's they? Which kids are they?
Right.
So I ask kids, you know, which kids cannot enter this problem? They're not going to be able to do this. Oh, I have 4 or 5 kids. Okay. Do they all have the same problem or do they have different problems? But which kids are going to be bored by this problem? Because you know what? It's too easy for them. They already know this stuff. Where's the high ceiling here? Where's the entry point for everybody? So that becomes a conversation about the who. And then we get to the how. The last thing we talk about is how you're going to do it. Because now that we know what we're trying to do and why we're trying to do it and who we're trying to do it with, we can look at a lesson plan in a book or wherever and say, is this going to do it? And if not, we have to learn how to adapt that lesson so it can meet the needs of a wide range of students. Or we need to replace that lesson with something that's better. That's what coaching is all about. That's the pre-conference. Then we go into the classroom with the teacher and we work side by side. So we let's say the teacher does a lot of talking. So you know what? We want to know what the kids are thinking. So we're going to slow you down. We're going to teach you how to make talk moves that get the kids to tell you what they're thinking so that you can then adapt what you're doing to make sure it reaches the kids. And so we might not model the whole lesson because we don't believe in that very much. We might do it once or twice, but we want the teacher up like an athlete on the field. So we're like a coach in baseball. We're at first base. You try a move we're teaching you, or you try a model we're teaching you, and we're in the like proximity of you, whispering in your ear or giving you some pointers, or maybe doing the model for you while you facilitate the conversation. It is true co-teaching. We find that teachers' practice moves much faster that way. And then we do a debrief, and the debrief is a reflection on what happened. It's looking at student work, thinking about what kids said, what we said, what questions we asked, what we wrote on the board, etc. What worked, and what's our evidence? Who did it work for? And then what didn't work the way we planned, or where were the surprises, and what are we going to do about that? That's our coaching cycle. It takes three full periods, a pre-conference, the lesson, a post-conference. And that post-conference spills you into the next lesson. That is a very sophisticated way of coaching. We also have to build relationships, just like in cognitive coaching. We also have to talk about pedagogy, just like instructional coaching, because the how is the pedagogy, and the how is as important as the what. But you can't jump to the how if you don't know the what. So that's a long-winded explanation, but that's content coaching. Our recent book, Agents of Change, which came out maybe 2 years ago, is a 10-year, it's like 10 years later. It has more, another video case study in it. It has more in it about how you get these initiatives going. How do you build a successful coaching initiative? How do you make sure that coaches are ready and trained to do the kind of work we're talking about? How do you build a culture in a school so that principals can change the, I already know this culture, or this is my fiefdom culture where a classroom is like a silo. And you do whatever you want in your silo, and then the principal comes in and evaluates, versus we're in the soup together, we're learning from each other, we're learning to open the doors and watch each other teach and learn. And how do we learn to develop lenses? So what we're looking at, we're looking at the same information to have a useful conversation. We're not valuing different things. This takes time, it takes work, it's not easy, you have to stick with it over years. It takes 3 years to develop a really good coach who's getting training. Never mind tapping somebody on the shoulder and saying, hey, you're a good teacher. You want to be a coach next year? Which is what happens in most districts.
And let's pause here for a message from our sponsors. Today's podcast is brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download and 30-day free trial at betterleadersbetterschools.com/book. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. You know, I'm just like you. I'm a school leader that wants to get better every single day, and that's why I created a free gift for you called The 15 Questions to Unlock Your Leadership Potential. You can grab it today for free by texting the word UNLOCK NOW to 33444. That's UNLOCK NOW to 33444, and The 15 Questions to Unlock Your Leadership Potential will be delivered straight to your inbox. And now back to our show.
It's a robust system. I love all the meat that you provided there. In the pre-conference, the observation, the post, and three class periods, moving into the next class as well. I mean, there's just so much there. You talked about that it's taken years to develop. You mentioned a couple books that we'll have linked up in the show notes. So appreciate the work there. And I love that they have some case studies and videos that people can check out so that they could take their learning to a deeper level as well. Do you have any tips in terms of building relationships so that you can have those type of productive pre and post conference meetings, as well as observations and debriefs?
Yes. What we've learned is you don't start the way I just said. That would blow people's minds usually. So you start by going into a school. Well, first of all, if you live in that school and you change positions, so if you were a teacher last year and now somebody says you're going to be a coach, you better get real clear what that means and be very humble about it, because you probably don't have the training it takes to be a really good coach. So think of yourself more like a critical friend or a peer coach or something like that. Now, if I lived in a school and I wanted to start coaching, I would actually look for a buddy that I felt comfortable with. And I would say to this buddy, I would like to start trying some content coaching with you. Would you be willing to co-plan lessons with me? Can we try them out in your classroom and talk about them afterwards? So in other words, create safety for yourself and work with somebody that you you're friends with, that would be happy to do this with you, that would respect you in that way. So that you start to get some sense of what a coaching cycle feels like, and you start to, you know, I would read the books I just mentioned or other books, and start by trying to get to know the other person, what the other person cares about, the lessons the other person is trying to implement and design, and meet them where they are. So that's number one. If I'm coming in from the outside, like our coaches do, then what we do is a similar thing. First, we sit with a principal and we ask, like, what matters to you? What are you trying to accomplish? How can we partner with you? We're your buddy. We're your friend. We're here to think with you, alongside you, about how to design and who to work with. So once the principal starts talking and telling us what she's struggling with or what her challenges are or what she's trying to accomplish, we try and figure out how to create a situation which is going to have leverage. Because you can't, generally speaking, unless you've got a gigantic budget, you can't work with every teacher in the school in the first year. So you have to pick and choose where you're going to work. Most principals want to work with the teachers who they perceive need to be fixed in some way. That is deadly. And the reason that is deadly is because coaching in education has been something that only people who are new in the name of mentoring, or who are not doing well in the name of we have to fix you, get help in, get that kind of help. We want to change that. We want coaching to be just like it is in the field of athletics, in the field of business, in the field of medicine. In other words, we want everyone to get to receive coaching. In particular, we want to start with the best. And the reason we want to start with the best is two or threefold. Number one, you start with the best because it sends a different message. You say, this teacher is respected by a lot of people. She's doing a good job. Let's see if we can start a conversation so that we could do even better, that we could start naming what she's doing. Can she name it? Are there places she could improve that she wants to improve? That, and we're not telling her, you have to improve over here. We're saying to her, what are your challenges? What do you go home at night? Mostly really good teachers go home at night and worry about something. What do you worry about when you go home at night? Like, which kid? What subject area? What's on your mind? Well, how can we come in and meet you there? So you start with a conversation with teachers that you think are doing pretty well, and you try and support them in doing even better. And you start that conversation by asking them what they care about, what they want to work on, and so forth. Now, a lot of times, so then you look for ways to bring other people in. So, for example, if the principal is concerned about teacher X, and we are working with teacher Y, we could start with teacher Y, work with her 2, 3, 4 times until there's a nice relationship, we're getting some good lessons going, the kids are starting to talk more, the math or whatever the content area is getting richer. And then the principal could say, you know what, I want teacher X to be part of this. So I'm going to release both teachers for 3 periods. You're still going to work in teacher Y's room, but teacher X is going to sit in. She's going to listen to these planning conversations. She's going to watch the lesson. She's going to sit in on the debrief. So there's not a lot of pressure on the fix-it teacher, but there's like a beginning of an immersion. There's a beginning of an opening that says, oh, we got these two people now thinking together, looking and watching each other teach. Maybe you bring in the whole grade level if you have 3 or 4 teachers on a grade level. So you do a plan teach debrief with the 3 or 4 teachers with this kind of lead teacher that you started to develop and have a good relationship with. There are many, many ways to expand the coaching gently and systematically and strategically over time. You start where you want. Maybe you want to start in grades 2 and 3 because the testing grade is grade 3, and you want to make sure kids in second grade are getting, you know, really fine teaching. So when they go into third grade, it's not as hard to bring them to the level of testing that you want to or whatever. So you have to be strategic because you only have 10 days or 20 days that you're hiring a coach for. Or if you have somebody who lives in your school, I wouldn't pull them out full time in the first year. I would figure out a way maybe I'd have two people coach, and they each shared a class, and they each taught half the time and coached half the time. So they kept honest. Because the minute you're not in a classroom anymore, you forget how hard it is to teach. And so we help people make these customized approaches that start with pilots, that start with a clear theory of action, build the leaders so that you now have a team of leaders who can work with other teachers. And now the coach goes on to another grade level. It takes a couple of years. It takes 2 to 3 years. If you enter into a school where you've got a learning culture, or at least the basics of a learning culture, it takes 3 years to probably move a school to the way that I'm talking.
Right, in a meaningful way, a way that's really going to impact teaching and learning. And, you know, we got to have patience when we're rolling these things out. What I like about what you described, too, is it's not that someone, you know, they're a chosen one and now they're just coaching, instructional coaching or content-focused coaching. I like that it's a slower rollout that really equips and empowers the person. They're getting developed, and I like that they might be doing it side-by-side with somebody else, trying to find a friend to go along with them on that journey, because there's going to be a lot of learning to happen, a lot of bumps and bruises, I'm sure. But on the other end of it, you're really impacting the school community. So I really appreciate you. Thank you so much for sharing that.
Sure. And I've watched many districts try and implement coaching, and many of them fail because they don't have a plan of action. They haven't thought through the roles. For example, what is the role of the principal in relation to the coach? What is the role of the coach in relation to the principal and in relation to the district? What is the role of the teacher in this situation? The relationship between the coach and the principal is a critical relationship that is rarely discussed. And we live in a bureaucracy and a hierarchy. And so if the coach reports to the principal, what relationship already exists? Usually if a principal is deciding on a teacher to be a coach in her school, if she's making that choice, there's probably a friendly relationship between her and that teacher. But what is it she really expects from that teacher? What does she mean when she says, I want you to be a coach? And who decides on the coach's schedule and who the coach is going to work with and for how long and towards what end? This is a mutual, in my book, this has to be a mutual partnership which goes against the hierarchy. So there has to be a place where the coach can come to the principal and together they can think about each of the teachers in the building like we want teachers to think about each of the children in their class. And as they do that, they're going to have to share some information that unions don't like people to share. For example, what is this teacher working on? Why does that have to be a secret? I don't get it. I have never understood why that has to be a secret. Wouldn't it be better to say, let's give everybody 3 or 4 things to choose from, and they have to be high leverage. You could be working on developing student discourse. You could be working on writing better lesson plans that include the who, the what, the why, and the how. You could be working on developing your content knowledge in X, whatever it is, like 3 things. These 3 things we could support. This school has the capacity to support this. But you, as a teacher, you have to pick one of these 3 things. I don't care which one you pick. You decide. That gives adults choice, which they need. They can't be told, you must work on this. But rather, these 3 things matter. They're very high leverage. Pick one. Okay, now how are you going to work on it? Well, you could join a study group. You could get coached. You could go to workshops and get coached. You could take a course. You could do X, Y, or Z. So again, there's a short menu of 2 or 3 or 4 ways that you could improve something. And that something is supported by the school. In other words, what's on that menu, the school has to be able to support. So if you want to go to workshops, then, you know, we can support you in that way. If you want to coach, we can help you with that. If you want to be a study group, then we'll have a facilitator for the study group and we'll buy the books or whatever it is. It has to be doable. And there has to be what I call a short menu of choices. And they have to be high leverage. So that kind of an approach prevents a lot of the resistance that people have in the field. And if the principal was really a learner, and learning these things alongside. Obviously, she's not going to join every study group and every workshop, but if she does some of that, if she joins a workshop, if she joins a study group, if she goes to a coaching session and listens in, that says more than anything that I am a learner too. I don't know the answers to everything. Even though I have principle written across my forehead, I don't know everything. And together we can figure things out. But that's a particular kind of understanding of leadership.
Yeah, I don't mind saying that myself. You know, I don't have all the answers, and just being able to, again, co-labor with somebody to get in the trenches with them and say, you know, we're going to figure this out, though. Even though I have this title, I don't have all the answers, but we're gonna do it together. I think that's a powerful way of approaching any types of problems. Lucy, you mentioned a couple of books, Content-Focused Coaching and Agents of Change, that you've authored. What's another book every principal should read right now?
Well, if you have this issue of how to talk to people, then I would read Crucial Accountability. It's a book written by, I'm not sure if Kerry Patterson is the first author or Joseph Grenny. It's called Crucial Accountability. And it's about how to have hard conversations with people. To me, it's like a little Bible. I learned so much from their work. And it's about learning how to have the kinds of conversations I'm talking about. There's another book that they wrote is called Influencer, and it's same authors. That like really informed me about how to make change. How do I help people improve? How do I break through the problems in the present culture that are preventing us from being learners, that are preventing us from really growing? And what are the most important things I need to focus on in order to do that? And so to me, those were books that really informed my work.
I've seen Joseph Grenny a couple of times in different conferences. So Crucial Conversations, Crucial Accountability, Influencers. I've read all those books. Love them all. Lucy, what do you do for fun?
I go to the theater a lot, and I travel. I'm going to Myanmar in December for 3 weeks to visit a country I haven't been to yet. My goal is to see the entire world. I'm probably a tenth of the way there, but I love to travel, and I particularly love to travel to exotic places with good friends.
Wow. That sounds like a lot of fun. Have a safe trip. I hope you really enjoy it. When did you say you're taking that? The summer?
December 23rd.
Oh, I missed that one. December 23rd. Okay, great. That's going to be awesome. What would you say was your favorite toy when you were 12?
I was 12. Boys?
Yeah, okay. That works. And this is the last question. Lucy, I'm proud of you. You made it to the end of the interview. You've been a phenomenal guest, offered so much value to the listeners. I know we're going to hear a lot about it. If you are building a school from the ground up, but you're not limited by any budget or resources, your only limitation was your imagination, how would you build the dream school, and what would be your top three priorities?
One thing I would not do is group kids by age. I would definitely interview every person, and I would want to know what turned them on, like what their passions were outside of, you know, math or whatever. But like, what do you really care about in the world? And make sure we built a school that spoke to those passions. And then I would make sure that we could travel, that the groups of people from the school could travel to places in the world, could do real things in the world that mattered, could do build, you know, a neighborhood garden, could travel to Africa in the summer or anytime and work with side by side with NGOs that are doing really incredible work. One of my heroes is Margaret Wheatley, and I've traveled with her. She's a friend of mine. She's helped people all over the world start amazing organizations that just don't worry about waiting for permission or policy or anything, and they just do stuff. And I would like kids to realize that we are powerful people. And when we put our minds to it, we can create whatever we want to create. And we can work side by side with people in this world to make it a better place. So I want to take them out of the schoolhouse and bring them into the world, even little kids. You know, I'm not sure how little, but I'd have to think more about that. But things like that interest me.
Lucy, thank you so much for being a part of the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast. Do you have any parting words of advice, and what's the best way to get a hold of you?
My website is probably the best. It's metamorphosistlc.com. And it's there's a contact. I get all the contact information. People ask questions, or you know, there's tons of resources that are free. A lot of the things I spoke about, the guide to core issues, ways of developing discourse, articles that we use a lot and love, tools, you know, that we think are good and so forth. So I think that's a good way for people to reach me and also to know more about the work.
Well, Better Leaders, thank you for investing in yourself today by listening to this podcast. Remember that life is 10% of what happens to you and 90% of how you react to it. Go out there today and be a better leader. Today's podcast was brought to you by Daniel and Lucy. Be better starting today by heading over to betterleadersbetterschools.com and type Lucy in the search bar. And the show notes page will pop up where you'll get the highlights of today's episode, links to all the resources, and the best way to connect. Lucy, thank you so much for sharing your leadership insights and helping the better leaders be better.
Thank you. Have a great day. Bye.
Better Leaders, thank you for joining us on the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast. Visit us at betterleadersbetterschools.com, a blog and podcast made specifically for you to help you meet your leadership potential. Have you gotten value from today's show? Help me reach even more listeners by leaving a 5-star rating and review. Click the podcast artwork and press the Show Some Love link to leave an honest rating and review. A long, long time ago in a galaxy far away, patrons would sponsor artists to create something the patron valued. Would you consider becoming a patron of the Better Leaders, Better Schools podcast? If you found this podcast valuable, if the show has pushed your thinking about leadership, and if you've benefited in any way, then I would be honored if you would become a sponsor. Sponsorship is easy. Head over to patreon.com/better or click the link in the show notes to become a patron for as little as $1 a month. If you pledge 10 bucks a month, I'll send you one of my favorite leadership books every other month. That's patreon.com/better or click the link in the show notes. Do you have a question or need some leadership advice? I want to connect with you. I read every email, tweet, snap that's sent to me. Links are in the show notes to connect via email and social media. Better Leaders, Better Schools is a proud member of the Edu Podcast Network, podcast for educators, podcast by educators. You can listen to more great education podcasts at edupodcastnetwork.com.